The priests had no army, no money, and no political power, but they had the authority to declare the gates of heaven shut. Now they began to wield it. Non-combatants, peasants and clergy, families and farmers, should be immune from ravages of battle, they announced. No matter whose army he fought for, private or royal, Frankish or foreign, any soldier who robbed a church would be excommunicated. Any soldier who stole livestock from the poor would be excommunicated. Anyone who attacked a priest would be excommunicated, as long as the priest wasn't carrying a sword or wearing armor. The decrees at Chavus recognized the potential overlap between priest and soldier, and were careful to avoid giving armed clergymen a free pass. The Synod at Chavus, the first step in a gathering movement known as the Peace and Truce of God, was the first organized attempt by the Christian Church to lay out an official policy on the difference between combatants and non-combatants in war. It took another tentative step forward in 994, when the Pope announced that the Abbey of Cluny, in the eastern Frankish lands, would become a place of refuge. When the abbey had been established around 930 as a private monastery, its founder, William the Pious of Aquitaine, had written into its charter a remarkable degree of independence. Cluny, unlike other private monasteries, was placed directly under the supervision of the Pope. No secular nobleman, not even the founder of his family, had the right to interfere in its government. Cluny, theoretically, answered to no political sovereign, nor was it under the authority of any local bishop. So, as a place of refuge, it could offer safety to anyone who made it to the abbey's walls, no matter how unpopular the refugee was. Cluny itself was protected by threat of excommunication from being invaded, sacked, or burned. The Peace of God movement was more than an attempt to sort out the ethics of war. It was a desperate response to a world in which the possibility of salvation and the mission of the Christian Church were increasingly tied to the territorial ambitions of particular kings. The setting of Cluny as a place of refuge gave the Pope, the man who was supposed to have inherited St. Peter's power to open and close the gates of heaven, ultimate authority to grant safety during time of war. But it was an imperfect solution. Just how imperfect became clear in 996, when Otto III of Germany reached the age of 16. The nobles of Italy agreed to recognize him as king of the land that had once been northern Lombard Italy, and now was simply the Italian kingdom, part of the peninsula, but not all of it, an appendage of the German realm. With the kingship of Italy in his hands, Otto III immediately appointed his 24-year-old cousin to be Pope Gregory V, the first German pope. At once the new pope returned the compliment by crowning him Holy Roman Emperor, protector of the Church, and ruler of the old Roman lands. The symbiotic relationship between pope and emperor strengthened both. It was the return to the days of Otto's grandfather, when the circle of power had first been created. But the return dealt a serious blow to the idealism of the peace of God. The Church could only offer peace and refuge during time of war, as long as it remained free from the state. Refuge could only be found in a place whose leaders had nothing to gain or lose from the king. Chapter 72. The Hardship of Sacred War. Between 963 and 1044, Alptigin establishes the Ghaznavid Empire by conquering the enemies of Islam, the Turks establish a kingdom by conquering the Ghaznavids, and the Chola dominate the south of India in the name of Shiva. The Islamic lands had fractured again and again. One caliph ruled in Cordoba, another in North Africa. The third caliph, of Abbasid blood, sat in Baghdad under the complete control of the Buyid clan. The Samanids ruled in the east, the Neo-Safarids in the south, and the Hamdanids near the coast of the Mediterranean. South of the Caspian Sea, the Ziyarid dynasty ruled over a little kingdom that had turned away from Islam and back to the old Zoroastrianism of the disappeared Persian Empire. And then there were the Turks, men descended from the once nomadic tribes of the northeast, who had come down into the Islamic kingdoms as slaves and soldiers, and who had risen slowly to claim greater and greater influence there. They had no titles, but they had strength. In 963, one of these Turks took the final step toward kingship. Alptigin had once been a stalwart general for the Samanid emir, chief commander of the Samanid armies. However, he had fallen out of favor the year before, when the Samanid emir died. Instead of supporting the emir's closest blood relation, his brother, Mansur, Alptigin tried to force the election of his own son to the Samanid throne. This indirect bid for power failed, and Alptigin left the Samanid capital just ahead of Mansur's hitmen, heading east. He arrived at the city of Ghazni, just southwest from the Khyber Pass, and conquered it. There he ruled as king over a much tinier empire, the breadth of one city. In 975, Alptigin died. His son-in-law, Sebuktigin, and his son, Abukishak, took control of the town together. Of the two, Sebuktigin proved the cannier politician. Alptigin had been content to rule as an outlaw king, but Sebuktigin had ambitions to build a real legitimate empire. He convinced Abu Ishaq to travel west with him to the court of Mansur, king of the Samanids, Alptigin's old enemy. There they negotiated a tricky peace. They swore loyalty to Mansur in return for recognition. Mansur agreed to make Abu Ishaq the legitimate governor of Ghazni, and to appoint Sebuktigin to the position should Abu Ishaq die. It is not entirely surprising that Abu Ishaq promptly died, leaving Sebuktigin as the Samanid-approved governor of Ghazni. Almost at once, Sebuktigin attacked and captured Kandahar, which for a short time had been in the hands of the Neo-Safarid dynasty of the south. He was still swearing loyalty to the Samanids, but now he was more than just a city governor. He ruled a territory that would slowly develop into a kingdom in its own right. This development worried the Samanids, but they had troubles of their own. Northern Turkish nomads known as the Karakhanids had begun to cross the Oxus River south into Samanid land, raiding the silver mines on which the Samanids relied. The Samanid army, busy fighting for its silver, didn't have energy to spare for Sebuktigin. But his expansion did not go unnoticed. At the capture of Kandahar, the nearest Indian king, Jayapala of the Shahi, began to prepare an attack. The Shahi kingdom, which controlled the Khyber Pass, had once been a Buddhist kingdom with Kabul as its capital. But Kabul had fallen into Muslim hands 300 years earlier, and the Buddhist kings had been driven from the throne a century before by a Hindu ruling line. The Hindu king Jayapala, who now ruled from the city of Udabandapura, launched several unsuccessful assaults against Ghazni. In retaliation, Sebuktigin attacked the western border of the Shahi and took some of Jayapala's territory away. Jayapala was forced to move his capital once more, this time to the city of Lahore. But although he shifted the center of his government to Lahore, he remained in Udabandapura, now the dangerous frontier of his country. The Samanids continued to be distracted, both by the raids from the north and by the increasing power of the Buyids to their west. Sebuktigin fought on. He captured Kabul. He battled his way steadily east into Shahi land, and by 986 it had become clear to Jayapala that an all-out war was on his hands. Observing the immeasurable fractures and losses every moment caused in his states, says the 16th-century Arab history Tabaqati Akbari, and becoming disturbed and inconsolable, he saw no remedy except to take up arms. He assembled an enormous army, perhaps as many as 100,000 men, and marched northeast to confront Sebuktigin near Kabul. They came together on the frontiers of each state, the Tabaqati Akbari tells us. Each army mutually attacked the other, and they fought and resisted in every way until the face of the earth was stained red with the blood of the slain, and the lions and warriors of both armies were worn out and reduced to despair. The battle was not a clear victory for either side, but Jayapala was the first to draw back. Sebuktigin's men were motivated not merely by the joys of conquest, but also by religious fervor in a way foreign to the Hindu soldiers who opposed them. Sebuktigin's battles against his Muslim counterparts had been motivated by sheer ambition, but in northern India he could exhort his men with a more worthy battle cry. "He made war upon the country of Hindustan," writes the contemporary Arab chronicler Al-Utbi, "whose inhabitants are universally enemies of Islam and worshippers of images and idols. He extinguished, by the water of his sword wounds, the sparks of idolatry. He undertook the hardship of that sacred war and displayed unshaken resolution in patiently prosecuting it." In the face of this holy enthusiasm, Jayapala sued for peace, paid his enemy tribute, and withdrew. But he was really gathering his forces. Unless he set his face to resist, Al-Utbi writes, his hereditary kingdom would go to the winds. As soon as he had managed to collect another army from among his tributaries and allies, Jayapala reneged on the deal and marched on his enemy again. Again he was defeated, this time just west of the Khyber Pass. Sebuktigin, vexed by Jayapala's breaking of his oath, seized the Khyber Pass for his own. He now owned the highway into northern India, And he proceeded to the country of the infidel traitor, plundered and sacked the country, dug up and burnt down its buildings, carrying away their children and cattle as booty. In the face of the sacking and burning, Jayapala retreated to the east, his kingdom contracting still further. Sebuktigin died in 997, ruler of a realm that had expanded well into the Kush Mountains, the Ghaznavid Empire. After a sharp and very brief civil war, his oldest son Mahmud claimed the throne. Mahmud's first great conquest was not in the north of India, but over on the western flank of his realm. The Turkish Karakhanids had now been harassing the Samanids for more than 20 years. In 992, they had rushed so far into Samanid territory that they were able to capture the capital, Bukhara, but when their chief died unexpectedly, they withdrew and gave the city up. Now, led by their new chief, Nasr Khan, they again pushed all the way to Bukhara and sacked it. This time they kept the city. The young Samanid emir withdrew to the south of the Oxus River. The Karakhanids seized the territory around Bukhara for their own, while Mahmud, now the strongest ruler in those parts, claimed the rest of the Samanid land north of the Oxus for the Ghaznavids. The strongest opponent of Ghaznavid power was now Jayapala, and Mahmud made an oath. He would invade India every year until the northern lands were his. On November 27th, 1001, Mahmud Ghazni met Jayapala and his army just on the other side of the Khyber Pass, near Peshawar. Once again, the hard-fought battle damaged both armies. Swords flashed like lightning amid the blackness of clouds, writes Al-Utbi, and fountains of blood flowed like the fall of setting stars. Jayapala lost heart. He had been defeated again and again, each time backing slowly away from his enemy, and he was humiliated and sinking into despair. Not long after the battle at Peshawar, he built himself a funeral pyre, entered it, and set it on fire. His son Anandapala took up the resistance. Like his father, he fought hard against the persistent invaders, and Mahmud's advance into the Indus Delta was a slow progression of 2 steps forward and 1 step back. But mile by laborious mile, he moved deeper and deeper into lands that had once been Shahi. By 1006, after 5 years of bloody fighting, he had made his way into the upper lands of the Delta. By 1009, he controlled most of the Punjab. Around 1015, Jayapala's son Anandapala, the last Shahi king, was driven completely from his lands and disappeared into exile. The list of conquests dragged on. In 1018, Mahmud even made an advance to the walls of Kannauj itself, where he slaughtered the remnants of the Pratihara army and drove the Pratihara king out of his capital. As he moved farther east, his fast, mobile cavalry proved impossible for the slower armies of foot soldiers and elephants to resist. His devastation had now enveloped most of India's northwestern quarter. He circled around the outside of the territory he had laid waste, and in 1025 reached the height of his conquests in India. He arrived at the harbour town of Somnath, on the western coast, where one of the most sacred images of Shiva stood, and where hundreds of thousands of pilgrims travelled to pay devotion to the god. The Ghaznavid army slaughtered thousands of pilgrims and sacked the temple of Shiva. Mahmud himself toppled the image, pulverized the head and shoulders, and ordered the rest taken back to Ghazni. There, he placed it at the foot of the steps into the mosque, so that Muslim worshippers could wipe their feet on it as they entered. His entire life had been spent in victorious empire building. Now, at the end, he could boast that those victories were the triumph of his god over the gods of the enemies. 5 years later, Mahmud died of a malarial fever at age 63. His empire had already reached its high point. The fracturing of the Muslim East into separate kingdoms allowed for the sudden mushroom-like growth of any realm that was lucky enough to be led by an energetic and long-lived general, but the kingdoms that grew so suddenly into empires were equally likely to shrink. Mahmud had spent 33 years conquering his way into India, but another kingdom was already beginning to swell on the western border of the Ghaznavids, led by a warrior named Togrul. The unruly Karakhanid attacks had gained the Turkish nomads a little land of their own, and in 1016 the young chief, Togrul, had inherited the command of his own particular tribe. This did not give him much authority with the others. The Turks had absolutely no respect for an overlord, something that had shocked the Muslim traveller Ibn Fadlan. Journeying through Turkish land some decades before, Ibn Fadlan had earned the friendship of one powerful Turkish chief and had assumed that the alliance would protect him. Running into another Turkish chieftain on the plains, Ibn Fadlan demanded passage in the name of the Turkish Khan. The nomad laughed at him. "Who is the Khan?" he said. "I shit on his beard." But the tribes near the Oxus had land of their own, and they were surrounded by the rule of Muslim empires. They had begun to absorb the new standards of a settled people. Toghrul, as driven as the great Ghaznavid ruler Mahmud, took command of his tribe and began to conquer. While Mahmud was building his empire in northern India, Toghrul was building a realm of his own around the Oxus. And after Mahmud's death, Toghrul began to fight his way through the western Ghaznavid land. By 1038, he had reached the Ghaznavid capital of Nishapur and claimed it as his own. He had himself crowned there as Sultan of the Turks, overlord of his tribes. Which was not entirely true. Other Turkish chiefs were also on the move, and they did not yet recognize the overlordship of Toghrul's dynasty. But Toghrul was certainly the most victorious of the Turkish chiefs so far, and his conquest of the Ghaznavid lands to the west had given him the largest Turkish realm. By 1044, Toghrul's Turks controlled most of the lands west of the mountains, and the Ghaznavid Empire, which had begun as a Muslim dynasty in the Muslim lands, now existed only as a northern Indian kingdom. The image of Shiva had fallen in the north, but in the south, the god's devotees were gaining power. The Chola kings, devoted to the worship of Shiva and his goddess consort, had allowed most of their realm to slip through their fingers. Now, like the northern Ghaznavids, the Chola inherited an ambitious leader. Rajaraja I, who came to the throne in 985, began to lead his armies in the reconquest of the south. He wiped out the southern kingdom of the Pandya, which had revived itself under a line of pretender kings. He defeated the eastern Chalukya and made them his vassals. He fought against the powerful western Chalukya, forcing them to halt their own spread to defend their borders. He sent his men over the strait to the island of Sri Lanka. Western Chalukya inscriptions accuse the Chola army of atrocities, the slaughter of women and children, the massacre of priests, rape and pillage and plunder. But the ruthlessness of Rajaraja's conquests sent the Chola back up the rotating wheel of royal fortunes. Having subdued in battle the Ganga, Kalinga, Vanga, Magadha, Aratta, Odda, Saurashtra, Chalukya, and other kings, and having received homage from them, the royal inscriptions boast, the glorious Rajaraja, a rising sun, ruled the earth whose girdle is the water. He didn't quite rule the earth, but after 30 years of fighting, he dominated the south. To commemorate the extent of his triumphs, he built a huge temple in his capital city, Thanjavur, a temple devoted to Shiva, with 300 priests dedicated to the service and worship of the god, and 50 musicians who were salaried to sing the sacred liturgies. A mighty lingam, a seamless pillar with no features, a representation of the all-encompassing, transcendent essence of Shiva, more powerful and more sacred than the image that had fallen in the north, stood at its center. On the walls were painted scenes of Shiva as conqueror, Shiva as destroyer of cities. Rajaraja's son and commander, Rajendra, succeeded him in 1014 and ruled, like his father, for 3 full decades. This second long reign, following on the first, achieved what the Ghaznavids up north had failed to do, establish a hold on the conquered land that outlasted the death of its founder. Like his father, Rajendra was a vicious and skilled fighter. He reduced to ashes all the kings who stood aloof from him, his inscriptions tell us, wrought ruin, annihilated the country. Rajendra's great achievement was to set sail. He sent trade ships east to the court of the Song, carrying elephant tusks, frankincense, aromatic woods, and over 1,000 pounds of pearls. He also sent warships across the southern strait, carrying naval forces to the island of Sri Lanka. There, he claimed to have captured the lustrous pure pearls, the spotless fame of the Pandya king, the crown and regalia of the legitimate Pandya line, which had rested on the island since the Pandya flight there a century before, and which the Rashtrakuta kings had sought but failed to find. He then began a 2-year march up the coast of the Indian subcontinent, towards the lands of the Pala and towards the sacred mountain of Kailasa, where, as his own records tell us, Shiva is residing. He had captured the symbol of southern rule. Now he was heading towards the residence of the god, the symbol of northern dominance. His army crossed the rivers by way of bridges formed by herds of elephants, his chronicles tell us. The rest of the army crossed on foot because the waters in the meantime had dried up, being used by elephants, horses, and men. When he arrived at the Ganges, he was faced by the armies of the Pala king. The once great Pala kingdom had shrunk from its former heights, but under its long-lived king, Mahipala, had begun to grow again. Mahipala had been on a conquering spree of his own, taking advantage of the preoccupation in the northwest with invading Ghaznavids to rebuild Pala power in the northeast. Rajendra met Mahipala on the banks of the Ganges and won a great victory against him. But so far from home, he did not have the resources to follow up with an attempt at conquering the entire kingdom. Instead, he pushed past it, across the Ganges Delta, and forced the people along the coast to pay tribute. Continuing on by land would have taken his army even farther away from the resources of the Chola heartland. It would have been simple for the Pala army, or another hostile force, to come from behind, breaching the thin strip of conquests along the coastline and cutting them off. Instead, Rajendra led his army back home and began to plan a naval expedition. It launched in 1025, sailing all the way across the Bay of Bengal to land on the coast of the kingdom of Srivijaya. Srivijaya, dominating the islands of Java and Sumatra, controlled the shipping routes into Southeast Asia. The Chola armies, invading the island, collected tribute from the Srivijayan king and seized control of the routes. By the time of his death in 1044, Rajendra left a southern empire that boasted tributaries all the way up to the north and far to the east. His son, Rajadaraja, grandson of the great Rajaraja, inherited his crown without chaos or struggle. Never before had a southern Indian kingdom ruled so much for so long. The traditional division of the south into separate realms had ended. Chola language, Chola power, Chola customs now blanketed the south of India and were spreading across the Bay of Bengal into Southeast Asia. The wealth of the court, gathered from conquered cities and from trade with the southeast, meant that the Chola kings could now afford to support poets and scholars at court. Under the patronage of Rajadaraja and his successors, southern Indian literature bloomed. The poet Turuta Kadevar, composer of one of the most enduring southern epics, was from the same blood as the Chola royal house. His tale told of the prince Jivaka, skilled fighter and general, who earned the kingdom and then willingly gave it up. In victory, he had discovered the hollowness of all human achievement. Chapter 73. Basil the Bulgar Slayer. Between 976 and 1025, a steel-hard emperor rules in Constantinople. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is razed in Jerusalem, and the Abbasid Caliphate denounces the Fatimids as heretics. The death of John Tzimiskes from dysentery left young Basil II, at 17, a senior emperor in Constantinople. His 16-year-old brother, Constantine VIII, ruled as co-emperor, but the government belonged to Basil. Constantine spent most of his time hunting, with an occasional diplomatic mission interrupting his free time. Basil, the medieval biographer Michael Sellus tells us, always gave an impression of alertness, intelligence, and thoughtfulness. Constantine appeared to be apathetic, lazy, and devoted to a life of luxury. It was natural that they should abandon the idea of joint rule. Basil II had been a crowned emperor since toddlerhood. Now, for the first time, he had actual power, and the first trouble spot he had to deal with was Bulgaria. John Tzimiskes had annexed Bulgaria, but he had been able to control only the east of the country. Freedom fighters in the west, led by four brothers with the biblical names of David, Moses, Aaron, and Samuel, were agitating for independence. They claimed that they wanted the release of their imprisoned king, Boris II, who along with his brother and heir, Romanus, had been tossed into jail by John Tzimiskes. Basil II suspected that the oldest brother, the freedom fighter Samuel, was more interested in Bulgaria than in Boris. He decided to appeal to everyone's worst instincts. In 981, he set Boris II and Romanus free. By this point, at least two of the Bulgarian brothers had died in battle, and Samuel was in sole charge of the resistance. Basil hoped that if the royal family actually returned to Bulgaria, Samuel would be forced to admit that he was only using them as a useful rallying point. Then, a civil war might break out and bring the independence movement to a messy end. Romanus and Boris II made their way back to the west of Bulgaria as planned. After that, things went to seed quickly. They were challenged by a border guard, and before they could identify themselves, The guard killed Boris II. Romanus managed to convince the guard of his identity and survived. This turned out as well as possible for Samuel. Boris II would have claimed the throne and ruled on his own, but Romanus proved more amenable. Even more conveniently, he had been castrated during his imprisonment, so there would be no royal offspring. Samuel declared Romanus to be king of Bulgaria and simply kept power in his own hands, a turn of events that makes one wonder about the accident at the border. Basil had been right about Samuel's motivations, but this was not exactly the outcome he had hoped for. Now Samuel began to fight his way into Thracia, capturing Byzantine towns for his own. He also put his only remaining brother to death. Clearly he was positioning himself to claim the title Emperor of Bulgaria. Unfortunately, Basil's ability to strike back was hampered by ongoing domestic troubles. His general Bardas Phocas, a man of royal blood, the nephew of Nikephoros Phocas, convinced the troops in Asia Minor to declare him emperor. Bardas Phocas was a formidable opponent. Michael Psellus describes him as a man who believed life had wronged him, always wrapped in gloom and watchful, capable of foreseeing all eventualities. Thoroughly versed in every type of siege warfare, every trick of ambush, every tactic of pitched battle, any man who received a blow from his hand was dead straight away. In comparison, Basil II was less impressive. He had just grown a beard, Psellus writes, and was learning the art of war from experience in actual combat. While Samuel was systematically ripping away chunks of land from the western border, Basil was forced to mount an attempt to remove Bardas Phocas in the east. His overextended army was too thin to face Phocas's loyal Asia Minor troops, so he asked his brother-in-law Vladimir of Kiev, prince of the newly Christian Rus, to supply reinforcements. Vladimir sent him 6,000 Rus soldiers. These men, says Psellus, fine fighters. He had trained in a separate corps. The Rus didn't mix well with the Byzantine army, but on their own were a fierce and powerful company. In April 989, Basil led his combined Byzantine and Russian forces into battle against Bardas Phocas at Chrysopolis. The general's prediction seems to have been that Bardas Phocas would mop him up, despite the Rus reinforcements, but as Bardas Phocas led his supporters towards the imperial line, he fell dead from his saddle, victim of either stroke or poison. His army disintegrated at once and fled. Basil's men chopped up the body with their swords and brought the head to Basil. The young emperor's throne was temporarily safe, but Michael Psellus tells us that his personality changed drastically after this time. He became suspicious of everyone, a haughty and secretive man. He had discovered that to be emperor was to be always on guard, always alert, and never trusting. He decided not to send his Rus tribute fighters home. With Vladimir's consent, he kept them close to him. Like the Abbasid caliphs, he now felt the need for a personal guard from outside the empire, a guard that would be less vulnerable to recruitment by would-be conspirators. These Russian bodyguards became known as the Varangian Guard. They would remain in the emperor's confidence and in his personal service, his most trusted companions in a world filled with traitors. His opinion of his own people was not improved when another general, Skleros, picked up the banner of Phocas's rebellion. Unlike Phocas, Skleros decided not to risk an out-and-out battle for supremacy. His idea was rather to harass the enemy by guerrilla tactics, without committing himself to open warfare, Psellus writes. Basil's transports were halted on the roads, shipments to and from Constantinople were seized, royal couriers waylaid, and their orders stolen. The emperor was unable to quell the guerrilla revolt, which dragged on into the next year and then the year after, constantly distracting him from his plans to launch a full-scale invasion of Bulgaria. Author's note, Skleros had already led one revolt against the throne and had been driven out of the empire. The opposition against him had been led by none other than Bardas Phocas, in the days when Phocas had been loyal to the throne, before Phocas had laid claim to it for himself. Finally, Basil took the pragmatic path and offered Skleros a deal. If the general would call off his forces, give up his claim to the crown, and retire to the countryside, Basil would grant him the rank of second in the empire and give all of his supporters immunity. Skleros was growing old. By now he was walking with difficulty, relying on bodyguards to help him move, and he accepted the emperor's bargain. Michael Psellus says that Basil then asked Skleros, as an experienced general and the leader of a successful rebellion, for advice. How could he preserve the empire from dissension in the future? Skleros answered with searing honesty. Cut down the governors who become overproud, he said. Let no generals on campaign have too many resources. Exhaust them with unjust exactions, to keep them busied with their own affairs. Be accessible to no one. Share with few your most intimate plans. The council matched Basil's own inclinations, to be private, withdrawn, and thoroughly in control. As he turned to face the external threats to his rule, he extended an autocratic control over the internal affairs of the empire, standing entirely alone at the top. He alone introduced new measures. He alone disposed his military forces, Celis writes. As for civil administration, he governed not in accordance with the written laws, but following the unwritten dictates of his own intuition. All his natural desires were kept under stern control, and the man was as hard as steel. He campaigned year-round, fighting throughout the cold of winter and the heat of summer. His ambition, Michael Psellus concludes, was to purge the empire completely of all the barbarians who encircle us and lay siege to our borders, both in the east and in the west. Any anger, any disappointed desire for loyalty, came out in his campaigns against his enemies on the outside. Those enemies lay on both the eastern and western horizons. Battling on in Bulgaria, Basil's army managed to capture Romanus and haul him back to Constantinople. This had almost no effect on the Bulgarian War, which just went to show how irrelevant Romanus was, and had always been. Samuel, who had been in control for decades, simply remained at the head of the Bulgarian army. Nevertheless, he waited until Romanus died in captivity to claim the title of king for himself. With Samuel's coronation, the dynasty of Krum came to an end. But Basil was now forced to leave the Bulgarian front in the hands of his generals, something that went against his inclination to stay in complete control. His presence was desperately needed in the east, where the Muslim threat had once again grown worrisome. It came not from any of the smaller kingdoms that had fragmented the east, but from the Fatimids of North Africa. In the decades since al-Mahdi's declaration that he, and only he, was the legitimate leader of the Muslim people, the Fatimid domain had spread eastward from its North African birthplace. By 969, the Fatimids had finally managed to seize control of Egypt. There, the Fatimid caliph, al-Mu'izz, directed that the foundations of a new Fatimid city be laid in his new territory. He moved his palace to this new city, which was named Cairo. By 973, the balance of Fatimid power had shifted so far to the east that Cairo had become the functioning capital of the empire, and the Fatimid caliph had lost control of the North African tribes in the Maghreb. Under the command of al-Mu'izz's son, al-Aziz, Fatimid armies spread across the Red Sea into Arabia and took control of the holy cities Medina and Mecca. Fatimid soldiers marched up into the Abbasid-held provinces of Palestine and Syria, and in a year of savage campaigning, conquered both. Basil's counterattack began in 995. He led a massive push into Syria and managed to recapture much of the land that had fallen to the Fatimid armies. His year-long campaign fell short of Jerusalem, which remained in Fatimid hands, a failure that would throw a very long shadow indeed. But Basil was not unhappy with the outcome. When al-Aziz died in 996, his 11-year-old son, al-Hakim, was appointed caliph in his place. Basil sent to him, suggesting that they negotiate a peace. He had retaken most of his Syrian lands, and he wanted to return to the fight on the western border. Al-Hakim and his advisers agreed to a treaty. The terms were finally concluded in 1001, and the war on the eastern frontier halted for 10 years. Basil rode back to the west to fight against Samuel. But after 4 years of slow, painful advance and retreat, the Byzantine front had progressed only halfway across Samuel's territory. Basil decided that it was time for a breather. In 1005, he returned to Constantinople to take care of domestic business. His generals held the frontier in place, while Samuel remained pinned in the west. For some years, the Bulgarian War was suspended. Meanwhile, the young Fatimid caliph, al-Hakim, was tightening his hold over his empire in his own way. He was a deeply pious man who wished to establish himself as the perfect Muslim ruler, just and lawful, austere in his personal life and generous in public. But his piety led him into a series of decrees that, although reasonable enough from his own perspective, sounded harsh and meaningless to the many non-Muslims who lived inside his borders. He ordered vineyards destroyed, so that wine, forbidden to Muslims, could not be made anywhere in his realm. He decreed that women in Cairo remain in their homes to protect their virtue. He commanded that the marketplace in Cairo be lit and open all night, demonstrating the complete peace and safety of his realm even in the dark, and forcing merchants to grab sleep throughout the day whenever possible. Like Basil, Al-Hakim was a man who closed his hand tightly over the internal workings of his kingdom, and over the 10 years of the treaty, he grew increasingly worried about the non-Muslims within the Fatimid kingdom. In 1003, he ordered the Church of St. Mark, just south of Cairo, razed, flattened the Jewish and Christian cemeteries around it, and built a mosque where the complex had stood. Throughout Egypt, Christian land was confiscated, crosses destroyed, and churches closed. And then, to discourage pilgrimage to Jerusalem, Al-Hakim ordered the great Christian complex built by Constantine destroyed, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which protected the tomb of Jesus, commemorated as the site of the resurrection, and Golgotha, the hill of crucifixion. The enormous stones were hacked to bits with axes, and the rock itself was removed from the city. From the Patriarch of Constantinople and the Pope in Rome down to the man on the street, Christians were aghast, but Basil, the nearest Christian ruler, refused to take immediate revenge for this act, since the treaty bound him to peace. He was getting ready to reignite the war against the Bulgarians, and a full-scale invasion of the Fatimid realm would have occupied all of his attention. Matters grew worse when Al-Hakim ordered the Jerusalem synagogue destroyed, early in 1011. Basil still declined to intervene, but the Muslims to the east used Al-Hakim's actions to denounce the entire Fatimid regime. The Abbasid court at Baghdad put out a decree under the name of the current Abbasid caliph, Al-Qadir, officially and vehemently denying the legitimacy of the Fatimid caliphate. This Baghdad manifesto was read out loud in mosques all throughout the Muslim world. It wrote into law the breach between the Fatimid and Abbasid caliphates. While the east boiled, Basil led the Byzantine army in a final enormous assault on the Bulgarian border. The two forces met near Kledion, just north of the Aegean Sea in the old Macedonian lands, on July 29th, 1014. Basil's break from the war, his refusal to take revenge on the Fatimid regime, had allowed him to rebuild his army into shattering strength. The Bulgarians were laid waste. A contemporary historian claims that 15,000 Bulgarian troops were taken captive and arrayed before the victorious Basil. Basil had absolutely no tolerance for treachery, even treachery carried out in the open by nationalistic freedom fighters. He ordered 99 out of every 100 captives blinded. The 100th man was left with only one eye, so that he could lead his comrades back to Samuel, who had remained back in the capital city of Ohrid. At the sight of his mutilated troops, Samuel, now an old man, veteran of nearly 40 years of war, had a heart attack and died. Without their chief, the Bulgarian resistance faltered. Over the next 4 years, Bulgarian nobles began to surrender to Basil II, one at a time. By 1018, Bulgaria was again enfolded into Byzantium, this time all the way to the Danube River. Meanwhile, Al-Hakim of the Fatimids had quietly gone mad. In 1016, he declared himself divine and ordered his name inserted into Friday prayers in place of Allah's. At this, his Muslim subjects joined the Christians and Jews in revolt. Al-Hakim ordered vicious reprisals, but in 1021, with his realm in total chaos, he rode off into the desert alone and disappeared from view. He was 36 years old. His successor, his young son, was guided by Al-Hakim's sister, and the Fatimid realm slipped further into disarray. Basil made no attempt to take control of the east. He was an old man by the time Al-Hakim disappeared, and he had always been roused to greater wrath by rebellion than by the opposition of other kings. His lifelong war against the Bulgarians had earned him the nickname Basil the Bulgar Slayer. He died in 1025 at the age of 72, and his crown passed on to his younger brother Constantine. Constantine was now 70 years old, and totally incapable of coping with either revolt at home or trouble abroad. Basil, who had spent his entire life stamping out rebellion, had never taken the time to marry. He left behind him an empire built on blood, but no heir. Chapter 74. Defending the Mandate. Between 979 and 1033, the Song Emperors fight to prove that divine favor is theirs. Three empires had spread themselves across the fractured east, The Song, drawing together the bits and pieces of China. The Northern Khitan, transforming themselves from nomads into the Chinese-style kingdom of the Liao, and the single realm of Goryeo. All three had united their lands by force, and the impulse to conquest did not stop just because the worst of the divisions were overcome. Song Taizong, now in his third year of rule, had done what his brother could not. He had conquered the last holdout state in the old Chinese territory, the Northern Han. Rather than halting, he decided to go on and attack the Liao borders. Unfortunately, his army was massively beaten just west of Beijing, in a defeat so shattering that it put Song Taizong's crown in jeopardy. He was already under a cloud of suspicion. More than a few army officers had muttered that his brother's death was too convenient to be anything but poison, and others objected that Song Taizong had usurped the throne of the dead man's son, Taizong's own nephew. But his victories against the Northern Han had temporarily silenced his critics. Now, in defeat, the complaints became audible again. The Song emperors had aligned themselves with the great Chinese emperors of the past, claiming the Mandate of Heaven to bring the divided country back to its former unity. The Mandate of Heaven always had a sting in its gilded tail, though. The mandate was conditional, held by the ruler only as long as he could prove himself worthy, and it made the removal of unworthy rulers a positive moral duty. Even more tricky was the proof that an emperor held the mandate. The mandate descended from the divine realm upon those who were morally upright, and gave the emperor victory against his enemies. So in practice, the strongest proof of the mandate was success in battle. The victorious emperor could claim, by definition, to be morally worthy, no matter what his private life looked like. The defeated emperor could protest about his upright nature all he liked, but the mandate had obviously been removed. Song Taizong's defeat at the border, he was so badly injured in the fighting that his men had to toss him into a donkey cart to get him away from the front line, tarnished the shine of the mandate. He had listened to army gossip. He knew that his officers might lead a revolt against him at any time, and that his brother's two sons could be installed on the imperial throne in his place. Back in the capital city of Kaifeng, he called the older of the young princes into his presence. By the time the audience was over, the boy had been made perfectly aware that his uncle intended to kill him. He forestalled the assassination by going to his room and cutting his own throat. In the next few years, the younger nephew and Taizong's own brother also died suddenly, and Taizong himself refused to name an heir. His crown was too unsteady. Instead, he tried to redeem himself by once again attacking the Liao against the advice of at least two high-ranking generals, who told him that the Song were not strong enough to wipe the northern enemy out. At first, this second campaign met with greater success. In 986, three separate divisions of Song soldiers marched across the Liao border, each headed for a different pass through the mountains. The Liao king, the teenaged Liao Shengzong, and his regent, the Empress Dowager Xiao, were taken by surprise. Bad intelligence led Liao Shengzong to believe that the Song would also attack by water, so he divided his army and sent half of it to the coast. The Song armies pushed quickly forward against the weakened Liao forces, taking cities in the west as they moved into Liao land. The Liao, writes a contemporary chronicler, was in very, very grave danger. But the Empress Dowager Xiao, a formidable old lady with a good head for war, was not ready to retreat. Under her direction, the Liao generals retreated from the Song forces, and then surrounded and attacked them from behind. All three Song armies were defeated. The Liao forced them to surrender and then took their weapons and food as booty. Song Taizong held on to his throne, after this second embarrassing defeat, only because he had killed off all of his possible rivals, but he was forced to give up any thought of recapturing the north of China. Instead, he turned his attentions back to the rule of his own realm, a place where he expected daily to be assassinated or betrayed. His fear of usurpation made him unusually suspicious of any official with royal, or even noble, blood. He also systematically pushed military officers into lower and lower posts, with less and less authority. He preferred to rely on bureaucrats of undistinguished families, who had passed the civil service exams with flying colours. Belonging to an old noble clan no longer opened a path into government service. The wars of the previous century had already fractured the great families, and Song Taizong's reliance on the examination system to appoint and promote his officials made noble ancestry even less important. His suspicious nature played midwife to a newly emerging Chinese class, professional bureaucrats who entered political office after years of studying to the test. The old scholar officials had pursued learning for its own sake. These new officials were more concerned with figuring out what answers the emperor wanted to hear. They became government officials because they had mastered a certain amount of knowledge and were able to parrot it back on the test to the emperor's satisfaction. They were well-educated within very specific parameters, and they were loyal to the emperor. When each candidate passed, the emperor met with him personally, hoping to dazzle the new recruit with imperial favor and persuade him into personal loyalty. The bureaucrats were generally dazzled. They had, after all, no other kind of power, no military accomplishment, wealth, or old family name. They were able, quick-minded, and completely dependent on the emperor. And they quickly filled the ranks of Chinese government. Song Taizong's willingness to appoint and promote anyone who had passed the exam attracted hordes of seekers to the capital. In 977, 5,000 men had sat for the civil service exams. In 992, over 17,000 tried their hand at it. Song Taizong finally named an heir to his crown in 997, when he felt his final illness taking over. His eldest son had gone mad, and his second had died. His choice fell on his third son, who shortly after his father's death was crowned as Song Zhenzong. The new emperor was 29. He had always been Song Taizong's favorite child, possibly because he was passive, agreeable, uninterested in fighting, and unlikely to grab his father's throne prematurely. Unfortunately, these were not useful qualities for an emperor who had inherited a kingdom with an enormous and growing bureaucracy and a hostile, ambitious northern neighbor. Yearly raids from the Liao were causing increasing angst in the northern reaches of the Song Empire, and Song Zhenzong's first big project was to build a series of canals and dikes along the Song-Liao border, dotted with well-garrisoned fortresses to keep the Liao troops out. It promised to be a formidable barrier, and as it neared completion, the Liao, still ruled by Liao Shenzong, no longer a teenager and hardened by 20 years of rule, launched a last major attack against their southern neighbor, bursting through the unfinished fortifications and sweeping southwards. Song Zhenzong folded. The raids of the previous years had seen Song soldiers killed, Song villages burned, Song farmlands destroyed. And although he had sent armies north again and again, the Liao threat had never wavered. The empires were deadlocked. In 1005, Song Zhenzong agreed to peace terms that were unequivocally humiliating to the Song. The Liao would give up their attempts to seize Song land. Both kings would respect the border and build no more fortifications along it. The Song emperor would address the Liao ruler properly, as an emperor in his own right, and the Song would hand over 200,000 bolts of silk and a massive payment in silver, equivalent to about 1.5 tons to the Liao every single year. Song Zhenzong told his people that the payment was a gift of an economic nature. Liao Shenzong told his people that the payment was tribute from a subject people. The Liao wording was probably closer to the truth. The Song were not subjects, but when Song Zhenzong signed the Treaty of Chanyuan, he brought an end to the first era of the empire's existence. Conquest had brought the Song into existence. Now the time of conquest was ending. Zhenzong had turned the empire's gaze from the outside to the inside, giving up the uncertain glories of conquest in favor of predictable and peaceful coexistence. For the next 15 years, Song Zhenzong devoted himself to domestic matters. His first order of business was to make sure that his people knew the mandate of heaven had not deserted him. He had not exactly been defeated by the Liao, but he certainly hadn't triumphed over them, and the jury was still out on whether or not the mandate was firmly his. In 1008, the emperor made a startling discovery. A sacred text, buried in the palace grounds, explaining that the Song dynasty reigned with heaven's favor. Then Song Zhenzong had a supernatural vision, which he described in great detail to his people. The mythical and sacred first emperor of China had appeared, and explained that he, the Yellow Emperor, had been reincarnated as Zhenzong's ancestor. Not only did Zhenzong have the mandate of heaven, but his clan was literally, more or less, descended from China's greatest ruler. It is impossible to know how much of this dog-and-pony show the people of Song China actually believed, but despite his weaknesses as a ruler, Zhenzong apparently had a flair for stage management. He put on a whole series of sacrificial pilgrimages and built memorial structures to commemorate each discovery and vision. Even more to the point, the Song people were growing wealthier and more comfortable in the absence of war. The population doubled in just a few decades, in part because Zhen Zong had introduced a new kind of rice into his country. He had bought thousands of bushels of a quick-maturing, drought-resistant seed from rice growers in the far south and imported them into the north for use by the Song farmers. The new rice grew so quickly that two crops per year could be planted and harvested, and its tolerance for dry land meant that fields farther north and higher up could now yield a crop. Song Zhenzong died in 1022, leaving his empress as regent for his young son. The new emperor, Song Renzong, embarked on his own solo reign when his mother died 11 years later. He was 24, and over the next 30 years he would preside over a richer and richer country. Without major wars to fight, tax money went not to the army but to roads, buildings, schools, and books. Books were in higher demand than ever. Like his grandfather, Song Renzong relied on the results of the civil examinations when he chose his officials, which meant that young men all over the empire were buying the standard texts and studying up, hoping to ascend the first rank of the professional ladder. The technique of printing books with carved wooden blocks, rather than writing them by hand, made it possible to produce multiple copies of the most popular books and to sell them for prices that wouldn't break a student budget. Song Renzong himself was a collector. A catalogue of his personal library lists 80,000 volumes. Woodblock printing proved useful in another way as well. Up until this point, the Chinese economy had been fed with heavy coins, which were awkward to carry even in small amounts, let alone large stacks. A system for dealing with these massive piles of metal had evolved. Merchants would leave their coins in special, privately run deposit houses, receive stamped receipts, and then use the receipts to buy and sell. Song Renzong, anxious to encourage trade, helped this sensible practice along. Sometime early in his reign, a royal office was established in the city of Chengdu to print these receipts in set amounts. The woodblock receipts, circulated through the markets of Song China, served as the world's first paper money. Giving up war had been an act of surrender, but the temporary peace that followed the Treaty of Chanyuan allowed Song China to grow rich. And prosperous and well-fed people, it turned out, were not inclined to be skeptical of the mandate, even in defeat. Chapter 75. The Newfound Land. Between 985 and 1050, Leif Erikson leads an expedition to North America. The biggest Mayan cities collapse, and the Toltecs leave paradise on Earth. Far to the west, the tiny Norse colony of Greenland was preparing to send colonists of its own to an unknown land. Erik the Red's son, Leif Erikson, had long wanted to follow up on a 15-year-old rumor that there were rich, hospitable lands farther west. In 985, the Norse merchant Bjarni Herjulfsson had arrived home to discover that his parents had emigrated to Greenland while he was off trading, so he left his homeland to go and visit them. He had never sailed the Greenland Sea before. When fog and north winds descended on his ship, he was unable to find his way. For many days, says the 13th-century saga of the Greenlanders, they did not know where they were sailing. When the sun finally came out, they found themselves off an unfamiliar forested coast. Bjarni's crew wanted to go ashore, but their captain refused. Instead, he set course back to the east and finally sighted the coast of Greenland. When he told the settlers there of his journey, the saga adds, many people thought him short on curiosity, since he had nothing to tell of these lands. Leif Erikson had no shortage of curiosity. He bought Bjarni's ship, stocked it, and in 1003 convinced Erik the Red, now in his 50s, to head up one more expedition to the west. The legendary explorer was reluctant to leave his home. He was getting on in years, the saga says, and not as good at bearing the cold and wet as before, but unable to turn down the challenge. As the father and son rowed towards the harbour where their ship lay anchored, Erik's horse stumbled and threw him, injuring his foot. Erik took this as a bad omen and went back home, leaving his son in command. Leif and his men sailed northwest until they reached the southern end of Baffin Island, and then down along the coasts of the North American islands and peninsulas. He named the lands as he passed them. Inhospitable Baffin Island earned the name Heluland, or Stone Slab Land, Forest-covered Labrador became Markland, or Forestland. Nova Scotia was named Vinland, or Wineland, since the explorers found grapes there and immediately put them to use. Leif decreed that the crew would build a winter camp on this newfound land and remain there through the cold months. Author's note, explorer Helge Ingstad and archaeologist Anna Ingstad found the remains of this camp in 1960 at Lons-aux-Meadows, but these were less severe than he expected. The unusual warmth of the medieval climatic anomaly still blanketed the northern lands. There was no lack of salmon both in the lake and in the river, the saga of the Greenlanders tells us, and this salmon was larger than they had ever seen before. It seemed to them the land was so good that livestock would need no fodder during the winter. The temperature never dropped below freezing, and the grass only withered very slightly. When spring came, Leif returned home with a ship filled with virgin timber, grapes, and wine. Eric the Red was able to see the long-delayed fruit of that original journey west just before his death in 1004. The shores of the new country, apparently unclaimed, seemed like the perfect place for a permanent colony, and the following year Leif's brother Thorvald launched an expedition to find the perfect settlement spot. He and his men settled in at Leif's winter camp and began to mark out the borders of farms and claims. For over a year they saw no signs of men or animals, except for a single wooden grain cover, left on a small island by unknown inhabitants. Then, during the second summer, they spotted inhabitants, 9 men and 3 hide-covered boats drawn up in a sheltered cove. It doesn't seem to have occurred to the Norsemen to make any sort of peaceful approach. They went directly into conquest mode. They managed to capture all of them except one, who escaped with their boat, says the saga of the Greenlanders, and killed the other 8. This brought an immediate counterattack. That same night, a vast number of hide-covered boats swept down the nearest inlet, with the inhabitants raining arrows upon the Norsemen, and then almost as quickly whisked themselves away. The retaliatory raid left the Norsemen unhurt, except for Thorvald, who had been fatally struck by an arrow in the armpit. His men buried him on the farm site he had chosen for himself and went back home. 3 years later, a wealthy and experienced Norse explorer named Thorfinn Karlsefni arrived on Greenland shores from the homeland. Within weeks he had professed his love for Leif Erikson's sister Gudrid. When Leif, now head of the family, gave permission, Thorfinn married her. That same spring, the couple decided to make another expedition to the west. Thorfinn hired a crew of 60 men, along with 5 women and plenty of livestock. This time the Norsemen intended to stay in the new land if they could. They arrived in Finland without difficulty and began to build a settlement. The new land was just as fertile as previous expeditioners had told them, and their timber homes were soon stocked with grapes, fish, game, and, thanks to a chance beaching, whale meat. Less than a year after their arrival, Gudrid gave birth to a boy who was named Snorri, the first European baby born in North America. But the natives of their new homeland were now on the alert, and the settlers were soon building palisades and arming themselves for battle. Skirmishes broke out, and there was at least one large-scale fight with fatalities. The saga of the Greenlanders gives few other details, but the attacks must have been seriously worrying, because the following year Thorfinn declared that he wished to remain no longer and wanted to return to Greenland. Another saga adds that the natives had catapults and were well-armed, and attacked while shrieking loudly. For this reason the Greenlanders called them Skrælings, the Shriekers. The Norse sagas give us a rare glimpse into the world of people who have left only physical remains behind, in the words of anthropologist Alice Beck Kehoe, a history without documents. The Greenlanders' settlement sat on the northeastern corner of the North American continent, a landmass that was probably populated millennia earlier, when the Bering Strait was still a land bridge connecting North America with Asia. Some of the travelers who came into the northern reaches settled on the icy shores. One town, just east of the strait, was built at least 500 years before the Greenlanders arrived on the opposite coast, over 3,000 miles away. Archaeologists have given its culture the name Iputak. The Iputak settlement boasted more than 600 houses and a huge cemetery, and the remains of the town are scattered with elaborate ivory carvings, knife handles, and harpoons. By AD 1000, another culture had grown up from the Iputak ruins and was rapidly spreading eastward to the coast. Archaeologists call the people of this culture the Thule, distinguished from their ancestors by their use of iron tools instead of stone. The fuel managed to displace the culture that had already grown up on the northeastern American coast, the Dorset, a seal-hunting people who gave way in the face of the invaders and scattered into oblivion. The Skraelings who fought against Thorfinn's men were either Dorset or Thule, possibly bands of both. We know what these tribes built, what weapons they used, what animals they hunted, and roughly how they lived. We know nothing of their stories, their histories, or their ambitions. The same is true of the tribes farther south. By Leif Erikson's day, the Hopewell culture had spread across what is now Ohio and Illinois, reached its height, and dwindled away. The Hopewell builders left behind enormous tomb mounds, each a geometric set of circles and squares, and a winding, mysterious earthwork, 5 feet tall and over 1,000 feet long, in the shape of a serpent devouring an egg. In their place, and slightly more to the south, the Mississippian peoples built cities. The largest of these was Cahokia, spreading across almost 5 square miles, with perhaps 30,000 people living in it. They have left behind them tremendous earthen mounds, the remains of foundations and well-planned streets, tools and figurines, burial grounds and sacrificial pits, one containing 50 young women, all apparently executed at the same time to accompany a great nobleman into death. Farther west, the Anasazi people built complexes from adobe bricks of baked clay and sand, rows of linked dwellings, some with as many as 700 rooms, housing thousands. The Anasazi were hunters, farmers, and turquoise miners. Their civilization reached its height just before AD 1100. The history of these North Americans, and the dozens of smaller tribes and states that spread across the continent, remains unknown. Archaeologists have pieced fragments together into kaleidoscopes that give us glimpses of daily life, but the large story of each civilization has been lost to the historian's view. Cahokia was as large as the Mesoamerican city of Teotihuacan, as populous as the Zapotec city of Monte Alban. Its rulers were as powerful as the Mayan sovereigns. But without written history, we know nothing of the names of their kings and queens, the nature of their gods and